Okay, so thank you very much, Prabhasra. So thanks very much for coming. I can see there's a mix of, old and new. It's great. I mean, I always see this centre as a living organism, and we are part of that living organism. This centre will die without people, you know, wanting to come in, using it, and being stimulated by what goes on here, and leaving the centre, thinking about what's been said, etc., etc. So it's good. It's good to see the new and the old, and the medium. So, yeah, as Prabhasra was saying, tonight we come to the end of what's been a series of four talks on consciousness. The first thing I'd like to say is that all I've managed to do is scrape the surface. I've scraped the surface of a scientific perspective. We scraped the surface, or Chris did, of a philosophical perspective. And really, I'm just, in the last week's and this week's talk, I'm just scraping the surface of the Buddhist perspective. One of the main reasons for me doing these talks is to provoke you, you know, to stimulate you into thinking, well, actually, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with what the Dharma says about this. And you go away and you find out more about it for yourself. I'm not up here. My intention was never to say, well, this is how it is, you know. My intention was to say, well, this is a perspective. Go away and think about it yourself. And, Buddhism is not, you know, if we really want to take up Buddhism, we take it up by thinking. We talked about the three layers of wisdom last week, about listening to the Dharma, reading about the Dharma, reflecting about it in our own experience, questioning it, yes, no. And then gradually, if we take it up, we become more of what we read and listen to. So that's been my intention of this series of talks. Now, I could have done a whole year easily on this subject. But I'm glad I'm not, because I've actually found it more tiring than I thought. So I'm going to start off with a summary. Okay. Now I'm not going to go through this slide, because this slide has been greeting you for the last 3 weeks. Okay, and I don't really want to say much more about it. What I do want to say is I just want to recap on what we went over last week. And one of the main points of last week is that mind and consciousness are of primary practical and doctrinal importance in Buddhism. They're the very stuff of Buddhist doctrine and practice. And as an example of the centrality of mind in Buddhism, I gave you these two opening verses of the very important Buddhist text called the Dhammapada. And for me, this says it all. The opening verse is skillful and unskillful mental states. If you don't know what that means, then like Aspabhasra in the second half, and preceded by mind, led by mind, made of mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows him, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. In other words, what we do with our minds has profound implications for ourselves and for other people. Or, the Buddha, and this is the Buddha, says, just as a fletcher straightens his arrow, so the wise man straightens his trembling, unsteady mind, which is difficult to guard and hard to restrain. Trembling as in the mind's going all over the place. So, you know, sometimes it hasn't really got a specific direction. Sometimes it just goes where it wants, at will. And sometimes that helps us and sometimes that doesn't. So we have this mind. We have consciousness. And it's what we do with it which is important. That's the whole point of the Buddhist doctrine and practice. And it's our responsibility. It's nobody else is going to say, Mahasraddha, I'm going to change your mind for you. I'm going to make you more happy. No. The Dharma says, if you do this, this happens. If you do this, this happens. Go away and think about it yourself, and work it up in your own experience as to whether you want to accept it or reject it. So, yeah, of course people can help me. Of course. I mean, I really agree with what Prabhasra was saying. I'd love to see the shrine room packed full of people showing their gratitude to the Buddha, as we've got the opportunity to do on May the 2nd. I'd love it. I need other people to practice the Dharma. I can't do it alone. Well, I can, but it's not going to be as effective. And I think this is, you know, there's the three jewels in Buddhism, Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And I think this is one of the jewels in my own life which I've, when in my early days, I neglected, but I'm seeing it more and more now, the importance of the Sangha Jewel, so other people can help. But it's up to me. It's up to me, you know. One of my friends says Buddhism is about taking responsibility for oneself and one's life. That's all it's about. So our own happiness or otherwise, it's in our own hands and can be found nowhere else except within our own minds. Oops. As this, again, it's the Buddha saying, a trained mind brings happiness. A trained mind in ethical principles, for example, brings happiness. An aware mind brings happiness. The wise guard their minds, which are subtle and elusive, wandering at will. A guarded mind brings happiness. Do you agree with that? Well, think about it. More than those, this is a really interesting statement. More than those who hate, more than all your enemies, greater is the harm done to oneself by a wrongly directed mind. Now, that is quite a statement, if you go away and think about it. The Buddha carries on. Neither mother, father, nor relative can do you as much good as a well-directed mind. In other words, the Buddha is again underlining the importance of the mind. The mind is central in our lives, of course. So mind and consciousness are the training of our mind are primary in Buddhism. But what is the mind? You know, what is consciousness? What are the boundaries? You know, when we define something, normally we kind of place a boundary around it, that computer. You know, I can kind of, if I call it a computer, I can see its boundary. It kind of gives its definition. But consciousness, well, where are the boundaries of consciousness? Where does my consciousness stop and Gary's begins? And vice versa. Consciousness just throws up some really interesting, I think, koans, actually. I don't think they can be answered by the rational mind. And more and more, as part of the preparation of these talks, I went to speak with some neuroscientists at the University of Manchester, and they all said that they're coming to the conclusion that consciousness is something which we're not, you know, we won't be able to put a label to. There's a kind of mysterious element of consciousness, which is always going to be reigning. If I spoke to those neuroscientists 5 years ago, they would have said that yes, we can fully understand consciousness through scientific approaches. Now, no. So consciousness is very fascinating. So last week we examined the questions of what is mind, what is consciousness, by looking at a very powerful, I think, and very moving story from the Buddhist tradition, which recounts the encounter and subsequent conversations between a great Buddhist teacher called Milarepa, who lived around, he was born around 1052. And a 16-year-old shepherd boy. And this encounter is quite amazing, actually. In this story, we saw that there was a boy, this shepherd boy comes across Milarepa. Milarepa's tendency was he was a wanderer, and he stopped in caves, and he taught those who wished to be taught. So the 16-year-old boy encounters Milarepa. The 16-year-old boy is ardent, he's bright-eyed. He's got a deeply inquisitive mind. He wants some answers, and he wants them from Milarepa. He wants some answers about what is mind, what is consciousness. And one thing we considered last week was the importance of bringing this kind of bright-eyed enthusiasm to our own questions. What, you know, what is life, you know, and what is consciousness? Why are you here? Why have you come tonight? And the story is called The Shepherd's Search for Mind, and I encouraged you to go away and look it up for yourself. It's on the internet, and as there are commentaries as well. There's also a brilliant, I think, seminar done by Sangharakshita on this story, which is available upstairs in the library. So do make use of what we've got here, including the library. So this is the kind of background, the backdrop of this story. Mountains, high mountains, small villages on the side. And in this kind of environment, this is where this encounter occurred, around maybe about 1072. not long, well, of course, after the Battle of Hastings. So Milarepa says to this young boy, in the house of the body, is there only one mind, or are there many? If many, how do they live together? And as we considered last week, it's not such a daft question, really, is it? Because I seem sometimes to be made up of different Mahasraddhas. Which one do I take seriously? And then we saw this remarkable investigation which the 16-year-old boy carries out. He comes back in answer to the Milarepa's question. Don't try and read that. I'm going to read it to you. He says, Dear Lama, last night I tried to find out what my mind is and how it works. I observed it carefully. Are you observing yours carefully? Maybe. What's going on in your minds now? And found that I only had one mind. How many minds have you got? Even when we want to, this is where it starts getting interesting, even when we want to, we cannot kill this mind. However much we try to dismiss it, it won't go away. If we try to catch it, it cannot be grasped. Nor can it be held by pressing it. If we want it to remain, it will not stay. If we want it to go, it will not go. If we try to gather it, it won't be picked up. If we try to see it, it cannot be seen. If we try to understand it, it cannot be known. And so on. And he concludes by saying, the mind is something illuminating, aware, wide awake, yet incomprehensible. In short, it's hard to say what the mind is. Now, I think that is an amazing response from a 16-year-old lad. So this whole story gives us kind of a lot to think about. I find it a very useful story to start thinking about consciousness. So what we kind of concluded last week via this story, one of the conclusions was that we can't really say what mind is. It's not, we can't really say there's such a thing as mind, in effect. At least not in the sense of there being an identifiable thing which we can turn around in our hands. We can't go, pull out consciousness wherever it is, gather it up in our body and kind of examine it like I can with this computer. And it's not something which has defined boundaries. And that's the consensus of science now as well as the spiritual traditions. The word mind is just that. It's just a word, mind. The human being is very complex. And to help us contemplate the nature of us, of a human being, Buddhism's very clever. It says, look, they've got this really complex thing. Let's break it down into something, into bits. And this is what science does. It breaks complex things down into little bits, which we can then reflect upon and then start putting the big bits together into a bigger picture. So Buddhism breaks the human being down into five prominent heaps or processes. And those of you who have been around for a while will know what they are. And they're called, they're called the five skandhas. Oh, I think there's a slide coming up. What's going on? Yes, there we go. So the five skandhas are form, we've got a body. We've all got a body. Feeling, we've all got feelings, which come through the senses. We've all got thoughts. The mind thinks, that's what it does. We've all got volitions. We've all got our minds are telling us what to do now, to write something or to look away or to scratch. And we've all got consciousness. So these are the five main things which Buddhism kind of chops us up into, if you like, or says these are present within a human being. What do you think? If you went away and thought about your own experience, what kind of list would you come up with? I don't know, but again, this is something which, this is a fundamental teaching of Buddhism. Go away and think about it. Can you come up with something additional to that list? So, the word consciousness reflects a category of human experience, and it's kind of just a word, just trying to help us describe a kind of identifiable heap. But of continuously changing processes. Consciousness is a continually changing process. not just with you, but with everybody in this room. Everybody's consciousness is changing in one way or another right now, right now, right now, right now, right now. And Buddhism asks us to look at it. Well, what's happening? How's it changing? So, you know, our thoughts are constantly changing. Of course they are. You know, can you say that you're thinking the same things which you were thinking a second ago? I'm not. Our bodies are changing. Do you know how many bodies die in your body every day? Go on, have a guess. Okay, is it hundreds?
Millions,
okay. Close. It's 1,000 million. It's 1,000, so that's good. So 1,000 million cells in your body are dying every day. Each one of those cells, by the way, contains 2 meters of DNA. Right? So your body is breaking down an enormous amount of material. If you multiply 2 meters by 1,000 million, that's how much DNA has been chopped up into pieces every day. So our bodies are changing. No matter what we think, we're changing. Volitions. Can you really say that what's driving you now is the same as what was driving you a minute ago? I don't know. And consciousness is no different. You know, consciousness in Buddhism, although we've got these kind of labels, if you like, they're just there, they're provisional, they're asking us to go away and think about them within our own experience. And, you know, our consciousness is changing. Things, as I say, going, they're coming and they're going constantly. And just like the breath, you know, in the mindfulness of breathing sometimes, you know, sometimes you get bored. Right, do you get bored just sitting there doing the breath? Well, actually, no breath is the same. It can't be. There's always something different about each breath you take. It might be in terms of length, it might be in terms of the relationship of the in-breath and the out-breath, it might be the sensations. So we've got all this information telling us that things are just, you know, we're processed rather than something fixed. So when you get bored of doing the mindfulness of breathing, just pay a bit more attention and ask yourself, how does this breath differ from the last one? So the mind is just a word. It's just a word. And one way which we kind of explored it a bit, or consciousness a bit last week, was using this term vijnana. Our consciousness habitually splits our world into our experience, into an experiencer and something experienced. That's what it does. You know, when you're sitting down on chairs and cushions, you're experiencing the sensations, but you're also aware that you're sitting on an object. And but the main thing I tried to point out last week is that in Buddhism, there's not just one consciousness. There's quite a few. And I pointed towards the 6 sense consciousnesses. They're really important in Buddhism. What comes in through our senses is really important. It's a really kind of important basis of practice. Just noticing what we're smelling, what we're seeing, what we're hearing, and how that kind of impacts and conditions our next moment of consciousness. So in this final talk, I just want to do a little bit more investigation of consciousness from the more kind of Theravadan Abhidharma perspective. Because I think that these traditions have got something very interesting to say about consciousness. Then I want to go on to look at a question. Why is it so hard to change? Why is it so hard to change sometimes our patterns of behaviour? Why is it so hard to change our responses, which we get so tired of sometimes? Why? Well, there's a really interesting kind of model of consciousness from a tradition called the Yogacara tradition, which I'm going to use to try and draw out that question. I'm talking here about models, yeah? I'm not talking here about absolutes, okay? So just bear that in mind. But all schools of Buddhism agree that there is no such thing as mind or consciousness in a sense of, and we're we're very familiar with this, those who have been coming for a while, in a sense of something, a conscious being separate, independent, a separate, stable, independent entity that is a permanent subject of experience. But this is exactly how I habitually experience consciousness, and maybe you as well, and how I interpret my experience. I interpret my experience, or I live my everyday life, as though there is a mind-ego that is kind of fixed and permanent, which is flowing throughout the day. That there's a continuity of this kind of ego experience. But as we saw last week, the key, one of the keys to investigating consciousness is to kind of, is to try and let that go, because the Buddhist tradition is saying that consciousness exists in momentary flashes, particularly the Abhidharma tradition. Momentary flashes of consciousness are arising and falling, arising, falling, arising, passing away, conditioning this present moment of consciousness, conditioning the next moment of consciousness. Consciousness only lasts for a very brief, any one kind of, if, I don't like to use the term, but a set of consciousness, it lasts for, we'll see in a minute, a very short period of time. According to the Pali commentaries, this is early Buddhism now, each discrete experienced moment of consciousness is said to last no longer than a billionth part of the time occupied by a flash of lightning, and I quote. So that's, when we're talking about flashes, we're not talking about these discrete identifiable packets of consciousness. We're talking about a billionth part of the time occupied by a flash of lightning. That's how the early Buddhism saw consciousness. So they saw consciousness not as something fixed or permanent or and so forth and blah, 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 but they saw the mind of consciousness as more of a stream of momentary flashes of consciousness, one following on from the next, each one conditioning the next moment of consciousness. And the great Buddhist interpreter, Buddha Ghosha, describes the mind in terms of a forest monkey or a wild horse, never staying still, always changing. And I think we've got to think, go away and think about this in our own experience. You know, is this really true? Or is it a load of rubbish? But we don't just, according to the Buddhist tradition, mistakenly, you know, assign a kind of a fixed, permanent, enduring self within our own experience. We also, as we saw last week, put it out into the world. This post, I look at it, that's fixed, it's going to last forever. The wood, the bricks. But take, for instance, a candle, right? And I think the candle is a really good analogy of this deep habitual way which we kind of interact with ourselves and the world in terms of seeing things as fixed and permanent. Take a candle which is burning. That one on the one of those on the shrine, just look at it. One of them. But whilst we know the candle is burning down, nevertheless, we tend to think, or I was watching a candle and I was noticing that I was thinking that the flame, there's just a flame which is the same all the time while that candle burns down until I extinguish the candle. But a few moments thought when I stopped, well, it told me that it's simply not actually the same flame moment to moment. It's not. It can't be. It can't be. And yet, you know, there's a deep assumption that that flame is just a flame. It's not changing. All we can say while the candle is alight is that there's a continual process of burning. That's all we can say. That's what's going on. But the way of seeing the world and experience ourselves as kind of fixed and separate identities, as I say, is deeply ingrained in our consciousness. Deeply, as we'll see a little later using the model of the Yogacarian perspective on consciousness. But the analogy of the candle flame is a very good one for considering consciousness. You know, when can you say that instant of flame stops and another instant arises? You can't. When can you say that one moment of consciousness has stopped and another one has started? I don't think, well, I can't do that. I can't. So go away and think about it yourself. Look at your experience, your consciousness. Just see what happens, you know. And can you get a sense of this kind of, you know, is early Buddhism wrong? Is it wrong in saying that consciousness is just momentary flashes of consciousness, one after the other? Is it wrong? Or do you get a sense of that? I got a sense of it when I was looking, as I say, when I was contemplating a candle flame. The answer is in your experience. It's not in the pages of a book. It's in your own experience. So the Buddhist tradition encourages us to think of our minds or consciousness as having the character of, and this is, I like this, of a stream or a river. It's dynamic and constantly changing, which is good news, or can be. I think that's really good news. Like a river of water, constantly moving onwards and towards the sea, the primary feature of the mind or consciousness is to reach out, to stretch towards, even seize hold of objects through which, and through kind of stretching out into the world and identifying Prabhasra or somebody sitting, I don't know your name, sorry, sitting next to Prabhasra or brick walls. And it's kind of saying, I exist because I can see those things. I exist. We were taught about how consciousness objectifies itself back onto itself and says, I exist. It's really interesting stuff. I'm going to plug this book again. Just go and read this. Go and read this book. It's by Sangharakshi. It's Know Your Mind. It goes into this stuff really superbly, really brilliantly. Now, the Abhidharma tradition also points out that the mind, as well as kind of grasping out and objects and repelling certain objects and pulling others towards it, metaphorically speaking, points out that the mind or citta is always accompanied by mental events. Now, Buddhism, as we saw in the Dhammapada verses, distinguishes mind and mental events. Mental events arise within the mind. And we'll see later what those kind of mental events the Abhidharma kind of enumerates. And in particular, I think this is a very useful way of looking at the mind. Mental events condition our kind of general state of mind. Particular mental events give the stream of mind or consciousness its particular character and flavour at any one moment of time. Rather, like some rivers are fast and flowing and tumbling over rocks, and others are kind of slow and meandering and a bit stagnant, maybe. And the distinction between mind and mental events, and I'm throwing this out for you to go away and think about, is likened to the following analogy. Mind is the activity of recognising somebody in the crowd. But we do more than that. We do more than just recognise people in the crowd. We work that kind of raw data up into something else. I like this person. I don't like this person. They've got this colour hair. They've got that shaped ears. They've got those glasses. Or I don't like... the mind works up the citta mind, gathers the data and works up and produces mental events. So just watch your mind. Just watch what happens when you look at things. Watch how your mind responds to people and situations in your life. What mental events arise within your consciousness? And what effects do they have upon you, your life, and those around you? So what kind of mental events, and again this is just scratching the surface, does the Abhidharma come up with? It's a mighty, mighty list. It's a really interesting list. They're all in here, okay? But just listen to some of these. Confidence or faith is a mental event. Self-respect or shame in terms of, just not living up to your standards. Decorum, non-hatred, non-deludedness. Diligence, tranquility, concern. Non-violence, equanimity, anger. Arrogance, indecision, lack of awareness. I'm not going to list all 52, I'll just pulled out some of them. Indignation, resentment, slyness and concealment, spite, jealousy, deceit, dishonesty, mental inflation, whatever, shamelessness, gloominess, lack of trust, laziness, inattentiveness, and so on. This list or classification of mental events by the Abhidharma tradition is really fascinating. Again, it's not academic; like it's claimed to come from spiritual practice and experience. Go away and read about it. It's fascinating stuff, and it's very practical as well, as I'll say in a minute. So, what's all the point of doing this kind of analysis? What's the point of saying, in our everyday life, one or more of these 52 mental events will arise? What's the point? Why did the Abhidharma go to all this trouble of classifying the mental events of the mind? Well, even when we conclude, or even when I concluded that the best way forward for myself in this world was to practice a spiritual life, and in the end I chose Buddhism, even though I kind of concluded that, I still feel muddled from time, and I still feel muddled from time to time when it comes to determine the nature of spiritual development. I just think, well, what am I doing? And I find things like this just really interesting, because it said, these are the mental events which are useful to cultivate, these are mental events which are not useful to cultivate. So this gives me something concrete to reflect upon. Ah yes, that's what the spiritual life is about. Those are the kind of mental events which I wish to encourage. So the Abhidharma's kind of classification of what happens in our minds can be very useful, and that it certainly has, for me, it's had a practical bearing over the years. Now, I just wanted to say a little bit more about from the Abhidharma before I move on to the Yogacara stuff. Because, again, I just wanted to say something which I find quite interesting. Now, there's certain mental events which all schools of Buddhism agree are there all the time. They're called mental events. And they're really interesting. These things are going on in your mind constantly throughout the day. And I'm not going to say much about them. They're just really interesting to reflect upon. Sense impression. We're getting senses, information through the senses all the time, including the mind, the thoughts. Feelings. We're getting feelings all the time. Veda, you've got feelings in your body now according to your contact with the body, with the floor. Some of those feelings will be pleasant. I mean, I'm really enjoying my contact of the skin on the soles of the feet with my floor. I'm really enjoying the flow of air across my fingertips. There's other bits I'm still a bit anxious, a bit nervous about giving this talk, so down there there's a bit of discomfort. Interpretation or perception. I'm looking at you all the time. I'm perceiving you all the time. And will or volition. Again, similar to the skandhas, these things are present all the time in our interaction with the world, according to, I think most schools of Buddhism. But they're happening. They're not happening as discrete packages, again, as the Buddha rightly points out. He says, whatever there exists of feeling, of perception, of consciousness, these things are associated, not disassociated. And it is impossible to separate one from the other and show their difference. What he's saying is sometimes it's impossible to pull out, these four different omniscient mental events, but they're still nevertheless useful models for looking at our experience. For whatever one feels, one perceives, and whatever one perceives, of that one distinguishes. And he goes on to say, impossible it is for anybody to explain the development of consciousness, independent of feeling, etc. So, the point I want to make here is that although we may be particularly aware of one of these omniscient mental events going on, for example, I'm aware particularly tonight of Vedana, of feeling. But I'm not so aware of the other three. I'm not so aware of what my mind's kind of doing with the data which is coming in through the senses. We're always, according to Buddhism, having a volition. Always. So what's going on in your mind now? What do you want to do? We've always, as I say in the skandhas, we've always got feelings and we've always got perception. Okay. But all of this basic point is just look at your experience. There's a lot of information in the Buddhist tradition to help you look at your experience, make sense of it, and do something with it. But this is all enormously fascinating. Well, I find it enormously fascinating. The Abhidharma, I think, really fascinating. But that's because I like analysis. I like understanding things by breaking things down and then putting the pieces back together again into a jigsaw puzzle. And this kind of analysis deals with the functioning of our mind in everyday life, which in everyday experience, helping me, or it has done in the years, to clarify what's actually going on in my everyday consciousness. And of course, the more we're aware of what's going on in our consciousness, the more we can clearly work on what's going on in our consciousness. Okay, so that's just a very, very brief skim over consciousness according to the Abhidharma tradition. Very, very brief. There's much, much more I could say. And I'm not saying what I've said is... It's my interpretation, so some of you might think, actually, Marshall has got it wrong, but go away and think about it. I want to go back, in the final bit of this talk, to look at the question of... Why is it so difficult to change? Why do I find it so difficult to change my responses? I'll give you an example. I was going to give it later, but I was doing some decorating recently. I was putting some of this stuff, which on the tin says, "Get rid of your unwanted contoured ceiling wallpaper. Just put it on." And yes, I fell for it. I fell for it, so I bought these two containers of this stuff, and I was putting it on, and I thought, they're liars. And I could feel this intense rage rising up, and I just felt really, really, really angry. And I thought, blimey, this is really strong. This tells you, Mahasraddha, what's still buried in your consciousness. When things don't go when you want them to go, this is what happens. So there's still, deep down in you, latent, or at that time it was expressed, something very strong, which is, really can't accept things not being the way I want them to be. So I want to start off by considering this question, why is it so difficult to change? By going back to Ratnaguna's, some of Ratnaguna's talks, and you remember, those of you there, he looked at the chapter 5 of the Sutta Nipata. It's a very beautiful part of the Sutta Nipata, I think. So I'm going to start with that. So as you remember, the Sutta Nipata is one of the oldest collections of Buddhist discourses in the Pali Canon. And it's a very important text indeed within the Buddhist tradition. And at this particular point... some of the disciples of a Brahmin were sent to the Buddha to ask him, you know, ask him some questions. And the Buddha was asked, how does one go about finding the truth? How does one become wise? And the Buddha gave this reply. It's great. I will explain to you the truth, not based on hearsay. In other words, he was saying that what I say, I experience. He wasn't quoting from books. He wasn't quoting from a tribal elder. He was quoting from his own experience. First, realize that this way is one which can be known here and now, as a result of which a mindfully living person releases hold on the world. Two points there, here and now. The Buddha's quite confidently saying that we can experience the nature of reality right here, right now. But I don't. He goes on to say, in every direction there are things you know and recognize, above, below, around and within. Leave them. Do not look to them for rest or relief. Do not let consciousness dwell on the products of existence, on things that come and go. Now there's a lot in that, but I put those two quotes up just to illustrate a point briefly. What the Buddha is saying, if you all you need to do to experience insight or see things a bit more clearly, right here, right now, you just got to let go. Just got to let go. You can solve the problem of mental and spiritual suffering by letting go, right now, according to what the Buddha is saying. Letting go of the various clingings that we have to views and assumptions about ourselves and the world. The views and assumptions which create an artificial sense of self, which then puts me, a me and a you, and I want things, Gary wants things, and we're like two magnets competing for the same iron filings. There's going to be trouble. But it sounds all so simple, doesn't it, again? Just letting go. Just stop grasping. Just let things be as they are. And, you know, very often, very early after the Buddha's enlightenment, he said, what do you teach? And he said, I teach the end of suffering. That's what he said, that's what I teach. So it implies that if we can just let go, we can let we won't suffer mentally and spiritually. But it's very difficult, isn't it, to let go? You know, why couldn't I just kind of, in my rage, just say, Mahashweta, this is the way things are. You're let down. But no, my rage persisted. I wanted to hit things and smash things and crack things. And I couldn't just let go of this stream of anger. I couldn't. So why is this? And this is the last part of the talk. We're going to go switch now from the Abhidharma and Pali stuff to some later developments in Buddhism developed by a school of Mahayana school called the Yogacara. In particular, it was this school of Buddhism was developed by a Sangha and his brother Vasubandhu. And a Sangha lived around 310 to and died around 390. Born 310, died around 380. This era. And this whole Yogacara tradition, Asanga claims, arose out of meditation, arose out of visions which experienced practitioners had during meditation. Visions which kind of helped them develop a structure of consciousness. And it's a model. It's a model. It's a model of giving us the structure of unenlightened consciousness and how it works. And I've personally found this model useful. You might not. There's plenty of models in Buddhism. Some suit, some don't. Some make sense, some don't. But for this one, it does for me. Now, the Yogacara distinguishes, I'm going to come on to this in a minute, eight consciousnesses. Okay? So very briefly, you've got the consciousness associated with each of the senses, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body. We're already familiar with that, the fact that we've got these consciousnesses associated with different organs of the body. But then we're also familiar with the fact that the mind itself is regarded as a kind of an organ as well in the Buddhist tradition. All of these are outward turning. They're kind of interacting with the environment, smelling, seeing, touching. In the middle, we've got what's called a klista manas. It's a kind of, I'll come on to what that means in a minute. It's just a kind of a very key kind of structure of consciousness. And the deep, so these are kind of levels of deep, of descending depth. Right deep down is the alaya vijnana consciousness. But what does all this mean? Why is this useful? Why have I found this useful? Well, the whole point, one of the points is that these consciousnesses, they're not static. It's a model. They're all, the Yogacara talks about consciousness in terms of consciousness is constantly transforming. It never stands still. Despite these categories, things are happening. It's just a useful model. Now, the Yogacaras say that this fellow here, Klista Manas, it's called the tainted mind. And what it does, apparently, according to the Yogacara, it gathers the information from the other six senses, these lot, and says, from that information, it misinterprets information and says, I exist. I exist. I am a real substantial self because I see things, I smell things, I touch things, I taste things, I've got thoughts. I exist as something, you know, permanent and substantial. But of course, according to the Buddhist tradition, this I is the root of all of our suffering. It binds us to the wheel of greed, hatred and delusion, hour after hour after hour after hour. So this fellow's got a lot to answer for. But so is the Alaya Vijnana as well, according to the Yogacharya. The Alaya Vijnana sits at the deepest level of our consciousness. And traditionally it's said that, well, at least in the Yogacharya tradition, enlightenment occurs at a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. So enlightenment occurs at this really deep level, a turning about in this deep level of consciousness. It's not superficial. Enlightenment occurs with a turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness, which according to the Yogacara is this fellow here. But what does this fellow do? Well, it acts as a store. It's called the storehouse consciousness. Every action which we do, every thought, everything we do with our body, everything which we say, is dropping seeds in to the Alaya Vijnana. And these seeds, under certain conditions, fructify. In other words, we're just dropping seeds of habit into our deepest seat of consciousness again and again, which just manifest themselves again and again and again. And both this manas and the Alaya Vijnana in the Yogacara are seen as extremely powerful forces within our consciousness. Vasubandhu likens these consciousnesses as like torrents of water which are ever changing and really powerful. It's like, you know, when you go and see a powerful waterfall. It's like that, you know. You look at the power of that waterfall and you think, wow, that's powerful. Well, Vasubandhu was saying, within our consciousness, we've got really powerful kind of, if you like, urges deep in our consciousness, which are shaping us all the time, habitually. So we're dropping seeds down into the, I've almost finished, down into the Alaya Vijnana all the time. What we think, what we say, how we act. And as I say, these seeds fructify. They don't go away, they kind of fructify under the right conditions. For example, if we lead a life of grasper, Mahasraddha, and grasped. I like this, so I'm going to pull it towards me. I don't like that, so I'm going to pull it. I'm going to push it away. If I lead that kind of life, I'm dropping, according to the Yogacara, seeds down into the Alaya Vijnana, which are reinforcing that kind of view of the world. There's Mahasraddha, and he's out to get what he wants. If I keep acting in that way, I'm going to keep dropping seeds down into the Alaya Vijnana, which will grow, which will arise. So in other words, I perpetuate habitual way of being. Now, the Yogacharya argues that with practice, we can start sending new seeds into the Alaya Vijnana. And this is where ethical practice comes in. If we can look at our ethical practice, we can start dropping in more positive seed, we can perfume, they call it, the Alaya Vijnana with ethical behaviour, so that gradually the deepest seat of consciousness starts to express, you know, ethical ways of being. So the Yogacharya is kind of saying, if we really want to change, our practice has got to be deep. It's got to be directed at these fellas here, which they're saying lie deep in our consciousness. We must have a practice, the Yogacharya argues, that has a power and consistency that can turn us around at this kind of basic level of consciousness. If we want enlightenment, that is. So this teaching of the Yogacara, it kind of gives us a metaphor for what we're actually dealing with. for the depth of what, you know, the depth of things in our consciousness and how it works. It gives an idea of the depth of the problem. But can I just say, the manas here is good as well. I think, finally, we need a sense of self. Of course we do. You know, you can't just go around saying, I don't exist, you know, I don't exist. Of course you do. You know, that's not how we experience ourselves. And I think, you know, having a sense of self, okay, the Yogacara attacks it, but I think it's also vital in terms of the practice of morality and the practice of the Dharma as well. It's by contemplating the self, contemplating you, that you undo you. By contemplating you and how you interact with the world, you can undo you for example, by contemplating and practicing ethical behaviour. And of course, we've got Sangharakshita's system of meditation. Insight is based upon doing lots of, in this system, a firm foundation of mindfulness, a firm foundation of metta-bhavana, and then one starts to do insight practices. In other words, forming a healthy kind of sense of self is very important in Buddhist practice. And without a sense of self, we wouldn't live. You know, if I walk out into the middle of the road and I see a bus coming towards me, if I don't have a sense of self, I'm not going to get out of the way because it's not important, is it? So it actually keeps me alive. So Buddhism also has finally, this is the final slide before I do a summary, if we can let go, what kind of qualities of consciousness can shine forth? Well, it uses words like luminous, unbounded, unfettered, naked awareness, unobscured by our thoughts, unobscured by, you know, these habits, these things which I experience quite frustrating at times, which just keep me bound into cyclical patterns of behaviour. And the Buddha, this is the final slide before I do the summary. When one seeks one's mind in its true state, it is found to be quite intelligible, although invisible. In its true state, mind is naked, immaculate, not being made of anything, being in voidness, clear, vacuous, without duality and transparent, timeless, uncompounded, unimpeded, colourless, not realisable as a separate thing, but as the unity of things, yet not composed of them, of one taste and transcendent, over all differentiation. So I find that a really moving description of consciousness, if we can just let go. So we've come a long way. We've come a really long way in these series of four talks. We pointed out that consciousness, the study of consciousness, is not new. You know, this is a cartoon of a drawing done in 1598. Sorry, 1600 I've got there, where, you know, deep dissections of the brain were already going on. And sorry, I'm going back to science now. And, you know, any theory of consciousness, when we look at consciousness, it has to explain, or has to consider, I should say, certain qualities of consciousness, like subjectivity. What is subjectivity? What is this experience of I? Self-awareness, sentience. We're all capable of wisdom, you know, all capable of being intelligent. An ability to perceive relationships between oneself and one's environment. We saw that I did not say that the human brain is where consciousness is seated. What I did say is that I think consciousness, the brain, is a very important part of supporting consciousness. And we looked at this tremendous organ called the brain and its evolution. But I did preface it with a quote from Karl Popper: knowledge and understanding advance not through asking for definitions of what things are, but through asking why they occur and how they work. And that's precisely the position of Buddhism. The Buddhism is not trying to define consciousness. It's asking you to look at how it works. And we kind of put it in perspective, you know, human beings with this wonderful capacity for consciousness, etc. If you look at us, you know, the appearance of Homo sapiens on a 24-hour basis, on a 24-hour clock, we've only been around a minute. That's not long. You know, so much has had to go on on this planet before Homo sapiens can, you know, we can sit here so much. Even on, you know, this process of, I was talking about photosynthesis. Without plants, none of us would be here. This wonderful capacity. You know, photosynthesis is a lifesaver for us. Without photosynthesis, we're dead. It's an enormously complex biochemical process. And we saw, you know, that, again, we're standing on the shoulders of these men and women. You know, hominids didn't just arise. Homo sapiens didn't just arise. Gradually, slowly but surely, species arose and they died out. And let's look at us here. We've only been around a tiny bit. Whereas Homo erectus was around for millions of years. We've only been around 200,000 years. Homo erectus was around for millions of years, but they died out. We can't assume anything. We can't assume that we're going to be around, you know, for millions of years, because I guess these species did as well. We looked at these marvels of evolution. You know, our ability to practice the spiritual life is seating on marvels. And we looked at one marvel, which is the neuron, which is found in the brain, and it's the main kind of building block of the brain. It's a wonder of evolution, this cell. It's had to evolve from a circular cell, and it's got tails, it's got squiggly bits and so forth. Wonder of evolution, even before the brain could arise. And we looked at, you know, okay, one of the fascinating things about the brain, it's not just its structure, it's how do all these different billions of neurons, how do they find where they go in development? How do they know where to go? And we're getting clues about how that arises. And then, you know, you've got these different structures in the brain, and they've all got to communicate with one another to give us a coherent experience of life. We've got sensations, we've movement, we've got judgment, we've got rewards telling us, if you do this behaviour, that's good. If you do that behaviour, that's bad, don't do it. And I'm going to give you a bit of a jolt when you do things which keep you alive. We've got memories, we've got pain, we've got coordinate, we've got visions, we've got vision, etc. So the brain is just holding so much together. And you can change your brain. Now, I'm not saying this to be materialistic. I'm just saying you can change your brain. And this, unfortunately, this is from comparing the structure of neurons within an addict and a normal brain cell. And you can say, over years of addiction, the brain does change. Some neurons, the structure of neurons changes. And, you know, as I said, science, and I get philosophy from what Chris was saying, is coming to the conclusion that consciousness is a mystery. And that's fantastic. Because, you know, if you didn't have any mystery in the spiritual life or, you know, trying to understand the nature of mind, what's the point? So what we're left with is that. But what we're left with is a series of unanswered questions, which I just want you to go away and think about. You know, think about the five skandhas. Think about how your mind works in terms of its relationship with the six senses. Think about this model of the Yogacara. You know, why is it so difficult to change? Why? Does this model make you... Think about, you know, make use of the Buddhist tradition in your investigation of consciousness. Make use of the different traditions and the different models which they've got. Because it's a fascinating area. But it's up to us. You know, it's up to us now. It's up to us. You know, as I said right at the beginning, nobody's going to do it for us. It's up to us. And as I say, the whole base of these talks was to throw things out and to get you to go away and think about it. So I just hope that you've got lots to think about. There's loads of resources in this building, in the library, for you to go and find out about the Abhidharma and the Yogacharya. There's loads and loads and loads of stuff. And of course, always come back to your own experience. Think about it within your own experience. So, good luck. I hope you come to some very interesting conclusions, and we'll see you next Monday for the six paramitas. Now, in the second half, I'm not sure what we're going to do. I think maybe we'll just meditate like we did last week, and I'll just drop in some questions. I mean, we could have a question and answer session, but I don't really want it to go heady. So, as I say, go away and think about it yourself. So in the second half, we'll just have a meditation based upon the shepherd's search for mind. What colour is the mind? What shape is it? Where does it exist in the body?